KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, with Uber drivers suing for benefits and graduate students unionizing, labor issues are once again in the spotlight in California. The Golden State has always had a rich labor movement, and in his new book, From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement, Fred Glass traces the struggling and the battles of labor from the Gold Rush onwards, and we'll talk with him about labor movements past and present, and that's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. As we approach this year's Labor Day on Monday, we've invited Fred B. Glass to join us for this forum hour. He's the author of a comprehensive history of the labor movement in California, titled From Mission to Microchip, and he's also the communications director for the California Federation of Teachers, as well as an instructor of labor and community studies at City College of San Francisco. He produced Golden Lands, Working Hands, a 10-part documentary video series on California labor history, and we welcome Fred Glass to this morning's second hour of the forum program. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here, Michael.
Glad to have you here. I guess the place to begin is just kind of a broad base. A couple of quotes from your book. Labor politics, well, the action is where the states are, and certainly you bring that out in your book. But also you say most history is labor history, and when you read your book, you realize that indeed a lot of history has to come under that rubric of labor history. So let's go back to the labor history in California, which I want to sort of flesh out in this hour with you, which I'm looking forward to talking about. California is very different. I mean, in some ways, it's significantly different, not only now, when you think of right to work, for example, in Michigan, or you think of what happened with public employees in Wisconsin, but it's been different all along the line. And as you point out, largely because of immigrants.
So I think you can say that there are two main themes that go on in mainstream narrative California history. One is immigration. We all came here from somewhere, and it doesn't go back in too many generations usually for most people who are here. And there's the gold rush. And I think these are the two defining elements. And I didn't really realize this until after I'd written the book and looked back. Immigration, pretty obviously. My family came here right after World War I on my mother's side and in the 1940s on my father's side. And so everybody has that idea that California was the land of opportunity that beckoned across the country and indeed across the world. From the moment that California was a state, even before it, it was the most diverse state in the country, precisely because of the gold rush bringing everybody here. So that's the other part of it, is that there was that initial gold rush that sort of validated the American dream narrative, that anybody can make it. This is the land of opportunity. People came here from all over the world to, if not get rich, to do better than where they came from. And California, with the gold rush, sort of said, oh, you can do even better than that. And we've had a number of gold rushes ever since that time, and people have viewed the changing economy in California, I think, over time as a series of gold rushes.
So no, your subtitle says it all, From Mission to Microchip, and I want to get into the idea of the mission and the microchips. It's like gold rush mining to data mining is the way you put it too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, in the late 19th century, we had the beginnings of agribusiness with the Bonanza wheat farms, which were kind of grafted onto the old Mexican land grants. And that made a few people rich, and that validated that narrative again. We had the oil coming in the early part of the 20th century, and that was, of course, called black gold by the people involved with all that. We had the movies where you could sit on a bar stool in Hollywood and be discovered and rise up to be a movie star or whatever. And through World War II, which was really the more realistic gold rush, which is working people coming from all across the country, African Americans from the South, women out of the kitchens, and working people getting a fair share of what was being made. But right up to the present day with, as you say, data mining and Silicon Valley. But the other side, if one side is gold of the California narrative and the people who made it as a result of coming here and becoming well-to-do, there were far more people who did not get the gold. And so that's really what the book is about those people who didn't get the gold but did not despair. They did something different. They organized.
Now, we'll talk about the people who got it and the people who didn't get it, because you certainly write a lot. It's a little bit like reading Howard Zinn at times. I mean, you get into this kind of narrative history where people speak. I want to start, though, with what you start with, which are indigenous people. Before the European invasion in the late 18th century, and you bring out the sense that work was something that was simply intrinsic to or integral to a life. You know, you build a canoe because you have to fish out of that canoe, and so all the effort goes into building that canoe. And then you have the Spanish conquerors who come in, and well, they build missions and the mission system, and they start having people work around the clock. And so you have a whole different notion of work that is imposed on the native Californians.
Yes, life being regulated by bell schedule was not something that the native Californians were familiar with or wanted to be familiar with. And so they were really the first labor force in California inside the missions. And it was not the way they had operated before the Spanish arrived here.
It changed their whole sense of time, as you suggest, by the clock, but also changed the whole subsistence economy.
That's right. I mean, you can look at almost anything and understand it by seeing it as a spectrum where the extreme tells you something about what the norm might be. And in the case of California labor history, what happened to the Native Americans was really that extreme that shows us what could really go wrong with having one group of people employed by another group of people.
Well, this is also the darker side of California labor history. I mean, the oppression of people of color, the oppression of laborers who were essentially underpaid and exploited to a great degree. And we talk about that particularly in the way that you talk about it. You talk about those who have and those who have not. Who built the railroad? I mean, you make this very clear. It was the Chinese who built the railroad and the Irish who built the railroad. But, of course, we got Leland Stanford and Mark Hopkins and Crocker and Huntington as those who built the railroad.
Yes. And I think this is also the implicit comparison that my book's narrative is built on, is that great man history is the way we usually think of the way history getting done. And there is no doubt that, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Bill Gates have a lot to say about the direction of history. They're in positions to be able to make things happen. So when we look at working people's history, I think that the first thing to understand is it's not made by individuals. Individuals participate. They make important decisions within it. But if working people are going to make history, they have to make it collectively.
You say something that's even in your book more condemnatory. You say that the dominant narrative in society actually devalues work and working people.
Well, I think that's true. I think there was a brief period of time, maybe from the 1930s into the 1950s, when McCarthyism kind of cut it off, where work was validated and working people, you know, you could see it in the art that was created in the time, in the plays, the WPA theater projects, in the public murals, in the concerns that people had for what is the majority of the population and what they do. That was visible in the iconography of that time. And every so often, you can see that again, but mostly it's not.
Our guest is Fred Glass. He is the author of From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement. Let's go back to the Gold Rush. That became a template, you say, for all California history. And the Gold Rush was really the first signs of organized labor.
It was. I sometimes hear from more conservative members of my union and other unions that unions are good for negotiating wages, hours, and working conditions, but really we have no business in politics. But if you look at the very beginning of the labor movement in California, it's right there in the Gold Rush where all these things happen at once and unions discover that they need to use these various tools in order to achieve the goals of common interest for workers. So you have the first strike in 1849 of carpenters who are trying to keep up with the cost of living in Gold Rush San Francisco, where the economy wobbled greatly from one moment to the next in isolation on the western end of the country. But you also had the first collective bargaining with the first union in 1849. 1850, union printers, newspaper printers. And within 2 years after that, you had union members running for office in the first labor legislation, both good and bad, pro and anti-worker being passed. So I think it's fairly clear that unions have always been involved in legislation and politics, and they can't do it any other way because what you can win at the bargaining table can be taken away in the legislature.
What I said earlier, though, about California being distinctive with respect to labor also applies to labor unions. I mean, what is it, about 11% nationally in terms of union membership, although it's, you know, been in decline and so forth, but here in California, 16 to 17%?
Yeah, that's correct. California remains an outlier. We are doing better. It's not certainly nothing like where it was at the peak in the 1950s and 60s when we had a third of the workforce enrolled in unions. But today at around 17%, California is a good deal above the national average.
That's amazing, by the way. It was actually 40% of unionization during that period when it was at its peak. And let me get into the history of that with you, because you get into it in the book. I mean, a lot of it had to do here's William Nolan facing off against Pat Brown, and it meant a great deal that Pat Brown became the governor, the father of a present governor, of course, Jerry Brown, because if it hadn't been Pat Brown, there wouldn't have been Fair Employment Act. There wouldn't have been really – I mean, he was a labor candidate in every way.
Yeah, he was. And I don't know that he started off that way, but he certainly became that way during the campaign. And as you mentioned, I've got a chapter in the book on sort of a little-known slice of civil rights history, which is its intersection with the labor movement here in California in the 1940s and 50s, where during World War II, I think many people recognized that Roosevelt, in response to pressure by A. Philip Randolph and C.L. Dellums from the Sleeping Car Porters Union, who threatened to have a march on Washington if Roosevelt didn't implement some kind of fair employment practices rule for defense industry, because minority workers were simply not getting hired, and when they were getting hired, they weren't being promoted in a fair way. And so starting with World War II, there was a fair employment practices idea and an agency during the war, but it went away. The federal law went away after World War II, and it then devolved to the states because conservative Democrats from the South blocked with Republicans in the Congress, and they prevented a national Fair Employment Practices Act from passing. So here in California, the labor movement, not all of the labor movement, the CIO, there were two separate federations of labor at that time. The CIO, the more progressive one, joined with minority organizations, with civil rights groups, with faith groups, and pushed for over 12 years for a Fair Employment Practices Act. And it took Governor Brown becoming governor to make that real, make it happen. Finally, he signed it after many attempts. But the other thing that occurred as a result of Brown being the governor of California is that what we did not have in California was the state falling into the right to work column, which William Noland, if he had become governor, had said he would make happen.
In fact, the political element that you spoke of, or political dimension, continues to go on, because I know that it's You've expressed a concern about extending what's going to be expiring, Prop 30. You want to talk about that? I mean, in terms of more tax revenue?
Absolutely. So the contemporary labor movement, like the progressive wing of the labor movement in the past, is for addressing economic inequality not only through negotiations in the workplace but also through tax policy. And it's, I think, fairly clear at this point in time. You see the New York Times, for instance, editorializing now on the matter fairly regularly. Economic inequality has grown greatly as the labor movement has declined. And one way to address this is to put in place some laws that can re-enable unions to organize. The laws enabling union organization have been curtailed through court decisions over the years, and that's been most unfortunate because 55% or so of workers in annual polls by the AFL-CIO usually say that they would like to be in a union if they weren't afraid of being fired. They should not be fired, of course. It's illegal under the National Labor Relations Act, yet thousands every year are. So one other way to address economic inequality, with unions unable to do it in the way they did in the past in the workplace, is to do it through tax policy. Here in California, We were in the midst of the Great Recession and watching as tens of thousands of teachers were being laid off, class sizes skyrocketing, other school employees being furloughed, in higher education, tuition skyrocketing, higher education being priced out of reach of working families and their kids. And so we put on the ballot, a united labor effort to put on the ballot with Governor Brown, Proposition 30, which asked the wealthiest among us to pay modestly more in income taxes, 1%, 2%, 3%. And what that brought into the state is $6 to $8 billion a year. It stopped the bleeding in education. It stabilized public funding and education. And tuition, as Janet Napolitano, your previous guest, pointed out, has been stabilized also as a result of that. She didn't mention that Prop 30 was the reason why, but it was. And so this year we have Proposition 55. Prop 30 is a temporary tax, and so Prop 55 would extend it for another 12 years, asking only the wealthy to continue to contribute that modest share more. There was another component, a small sales tax of 0.25%. That has gone away. It's not in Prop 55, so this is now a purely progressive tax.
Again, we're talking with Fred Glass. His book is From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement, and brings out a lot of stories. When people think of people, that is, of figures in the labor movement, they often think most readily, I suppose, of Cesar Chavez and of Harry Bridges. One of the things I have to compliment you on, though, is, you know, you bring out some other stories and stories that are important. It's like when people talk about the civil rights movement, they talk about Rosa Parks. But there were other people who were working and working hard and putting up with a lot. Rosa Parks was a wonderful figure in that movement, but there were all those other figures. And you mentioned, for example, a woman named Anna Smith, who was a disabled war veteran's widow, disabled from the Civil War. And just the role of someone like her, which has pretty much been obfuscated by history, is important to realize.
Yes. You know, labor history is about the labor leaders, but it's also very much about the rank and file, too. We try and draw attention to the fact that those leaders like Chavez and Bridges would be the first to say that they couldn't do what they did unless they were working with the members to make it all happen together, collectively. Now, you mentioned Bridges, and it's funny, he was, for our generation and older generations, an iconic figure in California. And nationally, he was, you know, a household name. And in the 1990s, I was kind of realizing what labor history is up against as the generations move on. I was asked to give a talk at San Jose City College on labor history, and I mentioned Harry Bridges, and there was something about the blankness in the room when I said his name.
I know the feeling, Fred. I know it all too well. Yeah.
And I said, do you know who I'm talking about? And so this was a class in labor history, a self-selecting audience. One person out of the entire group raised their hand to say that they knew who Harry Bridges was. And, you know, this was a guy who worried presidents in the decades that he was active in the labor movement.
Well, you also get into something else that a lot of the younger generation, and particularly we want to talk about that younger generation specifically now with the so-called gig economy with you and so forth. But the 1934 general strike, I mean, National Labor Relations Act was passed a year later and probably wouldn't have been passed. I mean, that general strike involved a couple of deaths. I mean, it was major news throughout the country, probably internationally as well. And now, again, you know, this is historical amnesia. Let's jump ahead, though, to talk about the gig economy. And actually, I'd like to hear a clip, and Howie, this is clip number three. This is Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom talking about how labor laws are outdated in the gig economy with companies like Uber and Lyft using contractors.
Something big is happening, and we're going through this radical shift in real time. Yet we have work rules and labor rules that have been inflexible, that were designed for a world that no longer exists.
There it is. I mean, something happening, and, well, it's already happened for all practical purposes. I mean, we've got a different economy. We've got people who are working in this gig economy, and it's changed the whole landscape of labor and the labor movement.
So it is changing it for sure. I have another word for the gig economy. I call it the casual labor economy. And I think about when I come to San Francisco, I live in Berkeley and work in Oakland. But when I come over here and I go up the former Army Street, which I'm always amazed is called Cesar Chavez, I I'm struck by the irony, the terrible irony, that along that street, of course, everybody who drives on it knows that that's where day laborers congregate, and they're picked up to do work on a daily basis, casual labor. And that was precisely what Chavez was attempting to address and change in the field he was working in, farm labor. And here's the avenue named after him where that is now going on and is more
By the way,
and
excuse
more.
Me, I'm sorry, Fred, but when we said 40% of workers were not union before, that was non-farm labor.
Yes, non-farm labor workforce.
I just want to make that distinction.
That's for sure. And so I think the best way to understand the gig economy as the most recent technological gee whiz iteration of casual labor. Employers have always looked for ways to pay their workers as cheaply as possible and to keep them from having as many rights as possible. It's sort of one of the raison d'etre of things like the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, you make a point that in 1851, labor was pocketing a lot of the money from the gold rush. And then by 1858, it was capital who was mainly pocketing it. I mean, you don't have to get into
yeah, once again, there's the gold rush template there.
That's the template. And also what's striking about that is the four great men, you know, Stanford and Huntington and Mark Hopkins and Charles Crocker, as you point out, they didn't build the railroads. But, you know, they deserve certainly a great deal of credit for the railroads coming in. It was immigrant labor and it was Chinese labor. But they were kind of failures in the gold rush. I mean, they were making money off essentially providing goods for those who were working in the gold rush.
Mining the miners,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's just fascinating to read through this labor history. And I wanted to actually – here's another clip we have. It's a leader of the SEIU, United Service Workers West, a union that represents janitors. And there's been this whole movement of justice for janitors, also represents security officers and other service workers here in California. It can be heard discussing the rights of contractors hired by tech companies at a 2015 rally in Sacramento in support of wage and labor bills. Let's hear.
We want corporations to have responsible contractors. We want them to be held accountable for following labor law, for not ripping off their workers, for paying them honest and fair wages.
There's where we are today. I just want to give, you know, not only the look back, but the look to the present and the look to the future. Yeah.
So this is why the labor movement is so involved in the movement for living wage, minimum wage increases, the fight for 15 here in California. You know, Governor Brown just recently signed a $15 an hour minimum wage that will come in stages. And I think the labor movement here is justifiably proud that we were part of making that happen. And we do that even though the vast majority of our members are not minimum wage workers. That's on behalf of the entire working class.
Well, I'm going to invite our listeners to join us. And in fact, some thoughts about California labor history, about the present, past, or future of labor here in California. Love to hear from you. Love to hear your thoughts, laborers or non-laborers. You can join us at our toll-free number. That number is 866. I know a lot of people may want to weigh in on the whole union movement because it continues to be a movement full of all kinds of, shall we say, strong rhetoric of one sort or the other. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can join us if you have questions or comments at that number, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With Uber drivers suing for benefits and graduate students unionizing, labor issues are pretty much again in the spotlight here in California. And in his new book, labor historian Fred Glass has written all about this and written really about the fight for rights over the past century and also giving us a lot of individual stories. The book is called From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement. And Fred Glass is not only the author of the book we're talking about, but communications director for the California Federation of Teachers, the AFT, AFL-CIO, and instructor of labor and community studies at City College, San Francisco. He also directed and wrote Golden Lands Working Hands, which is a 10-part documentary video series on California labor history. And I thought we'd hear a clip from that. In this clip, that is from Golden Lands Working Hands, a member of the teachers union reflects on the intersections between the labor movements and social issues and civil rights, which he observed when he fought for collective bargaining laws and better teaching conditions at California schools.
We were trying to build conditions for teaching to happen and learning to happen. And we saw it as a social obligation for this to happen. Eventually, we realized it involved a lot of social issues. And that meant racism, it meant economics within society at large, it meant the peace movement, a lot of things that were converging on the lives of young people.
Well, Fred Glass, those things have converged. I mean, the labor movement now is certainly a good example and witness to that. I'm looking at a question from a listener, though, named Stephen, who says, could Mr. Glass comment on the distinction between private and public sector unions? I'm a supporter of unions, but there is a danger in the public sector of unions gaining undue political influence to the detriment of the general public. And that's what we saw in the whole battle in Wisconsin, basically.
Yeah, I disagree with the notion that there's a difference. Unions represent for the public sector what they do for the private sector, the ability of workers to get together and work in their common interests. And for public sector workers who are public servants, part of that does indeed involve fighting for a greater share of revenues going to support services. We're doing that right now with Proposition 55, as we talked about a little while ago. But that's because those public servants, as the name implies, work on behalf of the public. And if you look at the historic roots of public sector unionism, they were left out of the National Labor Relations Act in the 1930s when most private sector workers got their rights, with the exception of domestic workers, some forms of healthcare workers, and farm workers. And by the 1960s, in the most prosperous society that the world had ever seen, public workers were making less, generally speaking, at the work that they did that was exactly the same as comparable work going on in the private sector. And they said, what is the difference here? And they realized it was those private sector workers were in fact represented by unions and they were not. So that's where that came from.
Well, this will continue to be an ongoing profound debate. But I'm also interested in your response to another listener named Jay, who says very flat out, don't trust unions. They have a long history of corruption, racketeering, and are one reason for institutional racism. By the way, is there any history of racism in California unions? Any written history?
So if you look at the chapters that I've got on the Working Men's Party of California and the early California labor movement, here was a, you know, the first Gilded Age. We're now living in what's often called another Gilded Age. But in that first one, you had in the 1870s these enormous and growing economic inequalities. And so working people, including large numbers in San Francisco of Irish workers, white workers, they looked at this and they did something about it. They formed the Working Men's Party of California, which briefly took power in a number of cities around California. And it was a progressive party in certain ways. It was addressing economic inequality by asking for greater taxes on the wealthy. They were looking at Stanford and Crocker and their mansions on Nob Hill and saying, we're unemployed and they have that. How fair is that? So they were looking at economic policies like progressive taxation. They were looking for free public education. They were looking for controls on the railroad, which basically ran California at that point in time. But the other side of the Working Men's Party of California, and the one that ultimately was its lasting legacy, was anti-Chinese racism. So I want to – you mentioned earlier Justice for Janitors, the campaign by the Service Employees Union that goes on to this day. But
it began in L.A., in fact. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it actually began back in Denver, but
in California.
Yeah. That's right. It began in L.A. around 1990. And this was the moment when we came 180 degrees in the labor movement, really, from where we had been in the 19th century when – anti-Chinese racism in response to an economic depression and the voices of racist populists like Dennis Kearney, the Donald Trump of his time, when those things were now buried and left in the past, because starting around that time, late 1980s and the early 1990s, the labor movement, particularly led by the SEIU and the Labor Council in Los Angeles, began to focus more and more on raising up immigrant workers.
Well, it is a history of battling against racism, xenophobia, exclusion, lower wages. I mean, when you talk about the role of unions particularly, but you also have to concede that there has been a lot of corruption in unions and there has been, you know, a lot to answer for.
So that you're talking here about a small number of unions within a big movement of 15 million people. You know, there has been, for instance, within the Teamsters or the Laborers or the Longshore Union back east, not the ILWU here in California, that kind of legacy. But this is a tiny percentage of unions where that kind of thing goes on. And in most unions where anything like that happens. And look, unions are made up of individuals, human beings, fallible human beings. It's not a perfect movement. Imperfect things happen. We're people. But I think if you look at the difference between how often things like that occur within organized labor versus how often it occurs in corporations and the private business world, there's no comparison.
I think it's safe to say Fred Glass is like the old wobbly song habit, sticking with the union. Just want to read one comment, then we'll go to our callers. Ann says, why the emphasis on working people always being about the male population? Why is women's work so underrepresented and undervalued as important work? Raising the next generation is important. And certainly that's a good rallying cry. I agree.
I couldn't agree more. I'm one of the early labor heroines in California. You mentioned Anna Smith before, who was one of the Working Men's Party of California. Despite the name of the organization, she was an activist and a leader within it, and she was one of the non-racist ones for the most part. But an early one that I think is really interesting is Kate Kennedy here in San Francisco, who was a teacher and who was an activist in the 1870s and 80s for equal pay for equal work, long before that, you know, term was the one applied
and
to
lest
women.
We forget, we talk about the farm workers, Cesar Chavez, but Dolores Huerta has to come right to the front indeed as well.
That's right.
Let me bring our callers up to the front here. Let me begin with Jade. Jade, you're on.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This is Reverend J.D. Benson. I'm one of the ministers at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of San Francisco. I certainly support healthy unions. I'm concerned about the $15 an hour minimum wage in this regard. I'm wondering whether unions have been in conversation about geo-indexing minimum wage. In other words, in San Francisco, $15 doesn't seem like enough. In Barstow, it may seem like too much. Across the country, there are, you know, small towns in Mississippi for which $15 is terrific. And then there are San Francisco, New York, other places where it's just $15 is still pretty low. So what conversations have the unions been involved in that reflect a concern for geo-indexing the minimum wage?
She makes a good point, Fred. Do you know about serious conversations going on about the fact that $15 as a minimum wage in San Francisco is not what it is in Barstow, obviously, or Mississippi?
Yeah, so that was part of the conversation, certainly in the legislative coalition leading up to the $15 minimum wage here. And in New York, I believe their $15 that they passed around the same time does do some of that geo-indexing. But I'm in complete agreement that $15, I don't care where you live, it's not enough. It's barely, if you have a family, $15 is not going to get you anywhere in San Francisco. And it's in most parts of the state, in most parts of the country, that's not really a living wage. So the problem is that what we're up against is every time we attempt to talk about a rise in the minimum wage. And this goes back to the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938. You can see the exact same arguments being made by the employers' organizations, which is, oh, we're all going to go out of business. And the big business, the big business folks speak on behalf of the small businesses and use their voice to
That's exactly what happened in the debates we've had. Although there were, you know, small business owners, for example, who called in and they were really at their wits' end. And it was clear that they were having some serious problems with continuing to stay afloat if they had to go to a higher minimum wage.
I sympathize with the small businesses that operate on the margins like that. But if an employer can't afford to pay a living wage to their employee, they should really consider whether they should be an employer or not.
We'll go to more calls here, and we go next to Brian. Brian, you're on.
Yes, thanks so much for the show. My question is, when will the California labor movement and the international unions, so-called international unions in Washington, D.C., start working to expand their rights, their membership ranks using the global communications network to unite with workers in other countries, the people making our clothes in Bangladesh, the people making our Apple products in China, the longshoremen and warehousemen in coastal cities around the world.
Brian, it's an important question, and I thank you for it. There's been a lot of talk for quite some time now, Fred, about this kind of unionization globally. What do we know now? Where are we?
One of the reasons why it took me more than 20 years to write this book, Ruining the Vacations of My Family and so forth, was that the labor movement does not have the kind of resources that it once did. With 11% density compared to the 33 or 34% that we once had nationally, a lot of things have been lopped away. One of the things that unions have economized on, and, you know, everybody's doing this with the shift to the web, communications has often been given short shrift. It's, you know, unfortunate, but if you have a core duty to represent workers in a workplace, that's kind of where you leave the bulk of your resources if you're forced to choose. So I completely agree with Brian that this is a really important thing. As capital has globalized, unions have not kept pace, and that's unfortunate.
And Brian, thank you for bringing that up here. Here's Joel, who wants to know, well, he says you briefly touched on the gig economy, but can your guest please speak about the role arbitration is playing in diminishing workers' rights in the sharing economy in particular?
I think that I don't know enough about arbitration to be able to comment intelligently on that. I'll give an unintelligent comment, which is arbitration is a choice of corporations usually. If they have a choice between serious workplace rules and the ability to move things into an arbitration system that's kind of gamed against workers.
Kim writes, please do not forget the importance of collective bargaining for nurses and the importance their unions play in patient advocacy. We have been instrumental in improving standards of care and implementing safe staffing ratios. Patients were at risk in California before these ratios became state law. Let me bring some more callers in here. And Bob, you're next. Welcome.
I have a question. Thank you. I have a question for your guest. Does he know of any movements towards unionizing Uber, Lyft, all of these rideshare programs? And is there anything in the works trying to get them unionized?
Been trying to unionize. Certainly Uber has. People in Uber have, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And I don't know a lot about that. My book sort of ends in around 2014, and Uber was really just starting to come in big at that time. But yes, anytime you have workers that are being exploited, you're going to find some who are standing up and saying, we can't do it this way. We have to do it in a way that makes more sense for more people. And in a casualized economy, the tide is running against that kind of organizing, but it'll still happen. It is happening.
And thank you, Bob, for that call. And we'll go right to another caller. John, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Good morning. Hey, Michael, I could hardly hear you over the telephone. So when it was set up, I could not hear what was being said on your program. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Sorry for that. I can't account for it. I don't know why.
Okay. Well, I wanted to mention it. In any event, my question is this. The unions are at a disadvantage when it comes to damages allowed for persons who are fired because of their union activities, because they're only entitled under the National Labor Relations Act to lost wages. On the other hand, people who are fired based upon their sex or their race, their ethnic background or age, are not only entitled to lost wages, they're entitled to general damages that include pain and suffering. And they may also, in certain circumstances, extreme circumstances, be entitled to punitive damages. Yet I rarely hear union activists arguing for changing that part of the law. And I'd like to get your guest's comment on that.
So the National Labor Relations Act was written in 1935 and amended to the detriment of workers and union organizing in 1947 and again in 1959, Landrum Griffin. The employers have had a long time to take shots at the labor movement and labor laws and things like penalties for employers that are abrogating worker rights due to union activities. It's been less time, just a few decades really, that there's been race discrimination, sex discrimination rules put in place. By the way, those kinds of rules were put in place in union contracts, spottily, but they were, starting before World War II. So unions are concerned about that, and we are absolutely concerned with maintaining the right of workers to protest and get damages when they need to under any circumstances when an employer is doing things that are wrong. But the employers haven't had as long to catch up with those as they have with labor laws.
Let me thank John for the call. I was struck by the fact that you were talking about unions in general and you use a first person plural. I mean, there is that sense of solidarity again. I mean, you're active in union, you're a union officer and so forth, but that feeling that we're all in this together, regardless of what kind of employee or what kind of labor we're doing?
So solidarity is at the core of the labor movement. If you don't have solidarity, you have virtually nothing, which is why Uber drivers who have a hard time talking to one another don't have much solidarity. They, you know, need to be able to talk to each other to be able to develop that. As the epigraph for my book, I have a quote from Harry Bridges. The most important word in the language of the working class is solidarity. In this country, with its emphasis on individualism and upward mobility as an individual, we swim against the tide in the labor movement by having solidarity as our mechanism to do better. You know, the 1% that made it through all the gold rushes here in California, 99 to 1 is not a particularly good set of odds for most people. But if you're in a union and you have 16% or 17% that are organized, that's a 1 in 6 shot to do something by working together with people instead of just on your own.
I was struck again, as I said before, by some of the first person narration that you wove into your book. And there was a miner who talks about how he said he felt like a brute. He didn't feel like a human being because it was just so relentless. The onus of just the work he was doing was so formidable.
So this was a gold miner who, of course, was not represented by a union. Later gold miners, after the main gold rush had subsided, when things had settled into an industry and, you know, you had hundreds of employees employed in the gold mines, then they did form unions later on in the 1860s. But those kinds of conditions still exist for all too many people right here in California. There are thousands of cases of wage theft. There are cases of workers being injured on the job with...
You're not talking about wage theft largely for undocumented or across the board?
Across the board. Yeah. I mean, it's easier for employers to get away with it with undocumented workers because in some circumstances, undocumented workers rightly fear that they're going to get deported if they say anything. But, you know, that idea that the employers banked on was actually used against them with the Justice for Janitors campaign because a lot of those immigrant workers, in fact, came from places where they had struggled for their rights as workers and learned that what you do is you stand up collectively. And they were willing to defy and not worry about being deported because they understood what was right in the circumstance based on the histories that they had come from.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Fred Glass. And we're going to take more of your phone calls. Let me go next to a caller in Oakland. And, Steve, that's you. You're on.
Hi. I was calling because we were talking about historic amnesia and people don't know who Harry Bridges was. And so I guess I'm wondering, why isn't labor history taught in school? I know it wasn't when I was in school. What can we do to change that?
Excuse me, I'm going to have to butt in here because it's not only labor history maybe that needs to be taught in schools more because of labor illiteracy or historical illiteracy. It's true about history across the board. And let me just add that, you know, you don't necessarily have at this point a recognition of the importance of it used to be, Fred, you're old enough to know, it used to be labor columns, all right, in the newspaper. There would be people who would be assigned to cover labor.
Yeah,
it's,
well,
it's obsolescent.
That's right. One of the casualties of moving to the web and the downsizing of newspapers is the labor beat. And that's been going on for a long time. There are, you know, maybe one or two probably positions left in the United States at major daily newspapers that are a labor beat. They call it workplace beats now if they have it at all. And it's people who are business reporters and really don't have any expertise in labor. But that's, you know, there's a similarity in why labor is not taught in schools. The textbooks that we use are controlled by big corporations, and they attempt to squeeze the maximum profit out of what they sell to the schools.
But you heard my interview with Janet Napolitano. I was talking about all the emphasis on STEM, that is, you know, science, coding, and the like. The enrollments, as a result, suffer. The number of courses that are offered suffer in other fields. It's not just in the humanities and arts. It's things like labor history.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can point to my own example. I've been teaching at City College for nearly 30 years. I've only teach this one class in labor history. This fall, ironically, just as my book is coming out that I wrote largely as a result of my thinking about the topic in relationship to my class, interacting with my students, thinking about what they needed, my class has been cut for this fall as part of the austerity measures at City College of San Francisco. They're doing an across-the-board 6% cut of classes this fall because administration, largely under the thumb of the ACCJC, the Accrediting Commission, thinks that the best way to save the college is to destroy it.
Now, I'm sorry to hear that you lost your class and that these classes are getting essentially deep six.
I hope we'll get it back in the spring. We'll see.
Well, here's a tweet from Carl that may cheer you up. On the, he says, this discussion of labor history is vital and important to understand our national history. Thank God it's recorded. And you can always send your children and grandchildren to the archives and listen to this hour if you feel so disposed. I feel disposed to bring you another caller on, though, and let's go to Sebastopol. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I'm appreciating the show. On Monday, the State Assembly voted for overtime protection for farm workers, and, you know, faith groups, environmentalists, unions were big supporters of that. I was interested that many of the agricultural groups said, you know, the argument they said was, we think that farm workers' income is going to go down on a weekly basis because employers will stop paying for hour number 40 and 42 and 43. So my question is, are you seeing in the history of the labor movement this kind of attitude the employers are saying, hey, we know it's better for workers than the unions? And I mean, the UFW, I feel like, probably has a better idea what is good for farm workers than most employers.
So I have a special place in my heart for the UFW. When I was graduating college at UCLA, I was active on the campus. That was really my first labor involvement, was working on the lettuce and grape boycotts. And, you know, they did something with the UFW and Chavez and Huerta's accomplishment, along with all the thousands of activists in that union, accomplished something that no union had ever done before for farm workers, which is built a farm workers union that lasted longer than a day or a week or a year or two. And so with AB 1066, which is what the caller was speaking of, the governor has it on his desk right now. The same arguments were made against it as were always made by employers, whether it's farm labor or anywhere else, as we were talking about before. You know, this is going to break us. We're going to not be able to make a profit. We're going to go out of business if we pay workers a decent living wage. Since the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, daily and weekly overtime has been optional for states, weekly overtime is mandatory federally. Daily overtime is optional for states. California does have it, but farm labor has been left out of it all this time, both for weekly and daily overtime. Farm labor is hard work. If you're working more than 40 hours in a week or more than 8 hours in a day, it wears on you. You deserve to be making the same kind of living wage as other people do. And you'll hear those same arguments, tired arguments, made again and again against that.
Well, when you write about the toolbox for, as you call it, for people who are in the labor movement, particularly union people, the farm workers sort of sum up a lot of those tools. I mean, they used the boycott, obviously, but also demonstrations and labor pickets and negotiations and really the whole range and legislative action, the whole range, as you say, of what you call the toolbox. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Steve from Berkeley. Steve, you're on.
Okay, quick comment. There's three kinds of strikes that work today. One is the BART strike because it screws up traffic so badly that everybody just pleads, okay, we'll pay you whatever you want. The second is the police strike, which works because the police scare people so much that people say, we need you. And the third one is now the nurses' strikes, because the nurses have learned that losing more than one paycheck means that everybody comes back. But if they go to two-day strikes every month or two, it drives the hospitals crazy and the hospitals cry uncle. And finally, the nurses are getting a fair wage. But no other strikes seem to work because no one can give up two paychecks.
It's true that there are fewer open-ended strikes than there used to be. And in fact, there are just fewer strikes, period, than there used to be. And that's a measure of the shift of power over the years away from workers and toward employers. I don't think that this labor movement would have been built. I think it's clear from my book and a cursory glance at labor history that the worker rights that do exist, that we still have, would not have been possible without strikes. That's the ultimate power that workers have. And any free society, any free democracy needs to have the right for workers to go on strike and for that to be meaningful. I think that with a greater sense of solidarity that may develop over time, we saw a spike in that with Occupy, and I think that's leavened the labor movement since the Occupy movement with a greater sense of solidarity and possibility. I think we may see a rise in strikes as a tool of last resort, and I hope so, because it's a really effective tool, one that needs to be utilized in the appropriate situations. I just want to say that one thing I hope my book does is I was a big fan of science fiction when I was a kid, and one of the reasons why was because it opened up my imagination to other ways of doing things. The way we do things today typically is very constrained in the workplace. We think that the employer has all the power and that's inevitable. I think labor history offers, like science fiction, a way to think about things differently. You see how people thought about the same situations in other times and what they did about it. It might have been more militant, might have been more effective. The difference between that and science fiction is that it actually happened.
Well, it is a thought-provoking book, and science fiction led to realities in many cases, and perhaps the book will have the same impact. It's worth the 20-year investment, by the way. It's a damn good book. Thank you for joining us.
And you can find it in Green Apple and Modern Times here in San Francisco. And Pegasus in the East Bay.
From Mission to Microchip, the history of the California labor movement. Thanks to Fred Glass, our guest. Thanks to you, our listeners. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.